This is Audible.
Hello, this is Beth Anderson, publisher at Audible.com. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is being made into a movie. We're talking today with Robbie Stamp, the executive producer of the movie and a longtime friend of author Douglas Adams. The immensely popular Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy started as a radio show on BBC Four in 1978. From there, The Hitchhiker's Guide was transformed into best-selling books and audiobooks, a TV series, a record album, a computer game, and even stage adaptations. Douglas Adams died of a sudden heart attack in 2001 at the age of 49. At the time of his death, he was working on the screenplay for the movie, which is now complete and hits the theaters on April 29th. Robbie Stamp, welcome.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
You are a good friend of Douglas Adams. How did you get to know him, and what can you tell us about what he was like?
Well, I was lucky enough to meet him back in the early 90s when I was a TV producer, and a mutual friend introduced us, and I talked to him. I remember very clearly, actually, on that first occasion we met, and he played some Bach to us because there was a point that he wanted to make about pattern and mathematics in the music. And we discovered a mutual love of the Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse.
Oh.
And we talked about a series he wanted to do on evolution. And I was then a documentary producer. And although sadly we never got to make that series together, we did go ahead and set up a company called The Digital Village and had a great time together really through the 90s. And Douglas was an enormously generous, kind man, and I guess I remember him most for just this huge intellectual curiosity. He was a great, great companion. You know, dinner was never ever boring.
Was he funny?
He wasn't a laugh a minute guy, but he was witty. He was insightful. His conversation would range from politics to science to arts to movies to gossip. He liked a good gossip as well, and you know, lots of wonderful, wonderful evenings spent, you know, drinking margaritas or champagne or red wine till quite late in the night. And he was just a very, very good companion. You know, if you were playing one of those games, you know, who would you invite to dinner? You'd absolutely. I was lucky because I had 9 years of being able to invite Douglas to dinner, but it's sort of abstractly now, I would think, you know, Douglas is one of those great dinner companions.
And what was his educational background? Had he studied?
Well, he was classically, I mean, he was educated at a school called Brentwood here in the UK. It was a sort of, you know, classic English private school education. He then went to Cambridge, St. John's, Cambridge, where he read English. So, you know, it was the classic arts English background, really.
No science, no technology.
No, none at all, and to his great regret. I mean, you know, because I think that intellectually what was interesting is that, you know, a lot of the things that he almost intuited with Hitchhikers, certainly the first Hitchhikers, when he was only in his mid-20s, that he went on to spend a lot of the rest of his life, if you like, backfilling a lot of the imaginative jumps that he'd made. And, you know, some of the great scientific thinkers of our day, like Daniel Dennett and Steven Pinker, and great, you know, computer thinkers like Alan Kay, one of the founders of the personal computer, they became close personal friends, and you know, he loved the company of scientists.
Do you consider yourself the keeper of the Douglas Adams flame?
Well, I've certainly had a role in trying to make sure that we do something of which Douglas himself would have been proud. And I mean, I feel the responsibility to Douglas very, very keenly. I mean, I feel the responsibility to his family very keenly, and I feel the responsibility to his fans very keenly, because I know just how much Hitchhikers in its various incarnations means to just how many people. So, yeah, I mean, I feel a responsibility, but I know that the team that we finally assembled to make the movie all feels the responsibility, and everybody has been very, very concerned to do the very, very best by the material, that, you know, the magnificent, unique material that Douglas created that they possibly can.
Robbie, for people who don't know about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, can you talk about why it's so popular and explain what it is?
if
you can.
I mean, what is the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? I mean, I suppose, you know, in its essence, it's a story of this very, very ordinary man, Arthur Dent, who, you know, one day wakes up to, you know, discover that his home on Earth is about to be bulldozed to make way for a bypass, and he thinks that's bad enough. But actually, minutes after his house is indeed knocked down, the Earth is destroyed to make way for a hyperspace expressway. They're just building hyperspace expressways, which are just like freeways in space, and the Earth just happens to be in the way, just, you know, the way that, you know, some houses which would need to be purchased on Earth might be in the way. And he gets catapulted into space and just meets an astonishing array of characters and has an astonishing set of adventures. But the one that we focus on in the first movie basically follows the first book, which is trying to find out what the ultimate question is. Having had the answer, which is 42, to life, the universe, and everything, it would help if we knew what the question was. And so he goes in search with the two-headed president of the galaxy, Zaphod Beeblebrox, and a girl he met on Earth called Trisha, who's now called Trillian, the person he thought was his best friend on Earth, who actually turned out to be an alien from a planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse, who is a researcher for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And is the movie intended for the hardcore Hitchhiker's fans, or are you trying to introduce millions of new people to the series?
We want to introduce millions of new people. I mean, we're very, very clear, however, that in order to do that, we needed to do something which the fans were going to love and enjoy, and we're going to feel was a worthy addition to the Hitchhiker's canon. I mean, we want to sort of, you know, be respectful of everything else that's gone before. I mean, obviously, movies have a tendency to sweep everything away, but, you know, we know that it's already there as just brilliant radio and brilliant books and a TV series which many, many people loved. But we knew we would not be able to reach out to millions of new fans unless we did something that, you know, the people who already loved it felt was going to be great.
And as these stories have been adapted from one form to another, has the story changed? Are there certain elements of the stories that do better in audio or in visual or in type?
I think Douglas himself always very much felt that, you know, because he'd created this universe, he would change it to fit whatever the sort of the constraints and the possibilities in the new medium were. So, you know, he wasn't frightened to make changes when he transferred it from the radio to the book, indeed to the TV. And a lot of the film has new material, but as I say, the good news for the fans is that it's brand new Douglas Adams ideas, which he was working on before he so sadly died. So although the story basically follows the first book, there's new stuff in there, but it's brand new Douglas Adams, which you know, is pretty exciting, really.
Meaning it was created by Douglas Adams?
It was created by Douglas Adams specifically for the movie. New characters, new plot devices, some great, extremely funny new scenes, and that sort. So, you know, the fans are going to get stuff with which they're familiar. Vogon Poetry, Marvin the Paranoid Android, Zaphod Beeblebrox, Trillian, Arthur Dent, the whale falling through the sky. They'll get a lot of stuff with which they're familiar, but they're also going to get some brand new stuff.
Can you give us any preview?
Yeah, I mean, the brand new stuff, what have we got? We've got a new character called Hummer Kavala, who is being played by John Malkovich, who was formerly a space pirate. He then ran against Zaphod Beeblebrox in the presidential campaign, and his intelligence lost out to Beeblebrox's slightly wild and crazy charm. And he is now a leader of a cult, which is a cult which Douglas mentions, or a religion Douglas mentions in his books, which is the religion which believes that we were all sneezed into existence by the great green Arkle seizure, and we're awaiting the coming of the great white handkerchief. And we've built that storyline up, and so that's who Hummer Kavala is, man. He leads this cult.
That's great.
It's very funny. We filmed it in London, in this enormous building in London, and, you know, had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of worshippers in robes and things. Great stuff. Other new stuff, we've got a brand new device called the Point of View Gun, which is a brand new plot device Douglas invented, which moves the plot along quite substantially, and it's called the Point of View Gun. And if I shoot you with it, you automatically understand my point of view, and you understand exactly where it is that I'm coming from, and that features majorly in the movie.
That's great.
Yeah, pure Douglas Adams ideas.
How far did Douglas get in the screenplay before he died?
Well, he'd written a screenplay before he died that, you know, he recognized still needed, you know, quite a lot of work. But, you know, the essence of the script is very, very much Douglas. And what I was able to do was make available to the writer, Carey Kirkpatrick, a lot of backstory ideas that were sitting there on Douglas's hard drive, notes, ideas for resolving scene problems, backstory ideas for characters and so on. So Carey was always able to go back to the source material, and I think very wisely sought to invent as little as he could possibly get away with, because he said, you know, Douglas has created this astonishingly inventive universe. You know, it's not my job to come and, you know, invent new characters, new planets, new plot lines. Let me work with what Douglas has created, but, you know, maybe bring a slightly different structural sense to it. And I think that's what Carey did, which is why there's, you know, there's a shared writing credit, which I know the estate were very, very happy that Carey got.
It's been more than 25 years since The Hitchhikers first hit the radio. Why has it taken so long to create a movie?
Well, I guess the reason, I mean, who knows? I mean, Hollywood moves in mysterious ways, and, you know, things have their time and their season, though, you know, I'm personally not a fatalist. I mean, I don't believe there's, you know, and Douglas certainly would have believed that, you know, there's some movie gods up there deciding, you know, with the when and the where. I think that sort of the slightly more serious answer is that, in a way, the very episodic nature of Hitchhikers, it was originally conceived as radio series, which, you know, Douglas was writing those episodes, you know, literally week by week. And I think that turning what was very episodic, very picaresque, you know, things, all these strange adventures happening to Arthur Dent, into a movie with a beginning and a middle and an end, you know, was difficult. It was a real challenge to keep that essence of what makes Hitchhiker special, its intelligence and its wit, and put it into a satisfying narrative form for a big movie.
The series seems so British, but the movie is being made in Hollywood. Has there been any kind of culture clash, and why wasn't the movie made in the UK?
I think that Douglas always wanted it to be a Hollywood movie. He was very clear about that. He wanted it to be a Hollywood movie. He wanted it made with all the, you know, the weight that having a Hollywood movie brings. And although it is a very British production, we've got some fantastic American actors in there. And I think that it's something that there really hasn't been, and there genuinely hasn't been, a big clash. The studio were very, very clear about this. They really were from the outset. Once we were getting close with a script and, you know, having Garth Jennings, this brilliant first-time director, on board, they wanted it made in such a way that was going to be true to itself. They didn't want a version which was, you know, trying to turn it into something that it wasn't, trying to turn it into some big, you know, classic, you know, huge space opera. It's not. And they didn't want it to look and feel like that. So they basically were saying, look, if there's a way of doing it where we're going to be faithful to the spirit of the original and we can reach out, then let's do it. And if there isn't, we're not going to do it. And so the pressure we've come under is the pressure to be faithful to the spirit of the original.
And could you talk a little bit about the cast? I know we've got Stephen Fry and Alan Rickman and John Malkovich. Who else, and were any of them Hitchhikers fans before they started working on the movie?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a great cast. I mean, a really cool cast, frankly. I mean, you know, with people like Alan Rickman and Bill Nighy, of course, over here, you know, leapt to prominence in Love Actually, playing Billy Mack, and Martin Freeman, who, you know, became so huge in The Office, playing Tim, the sort of the bemused and love-struck member of a paper merchant in Slough. And he's been able to go pretty seamlessly to playing, you know, bemused and intelligent in space. I think that in terms of the casting principle, I know that, you know, for everybody who's read the books or listened to the radio, everybody's got in their heads their version of their Marvin, their Zaphod, their Arthur, their Trillian. And, you know, we're never going to be able to, you know, obviously satisfy all those millions of individual pictures in your mind. So what you've got to try and do is, by really understanding the essence of the characters, really working with the grain, and casting some great actors, not necessarily very big screen stars who already have a persona which they tend to bring to each of their roles. So there's nothing that gets between you and seeing your Arthur or seeing your Zaphod. And the key thing really is that, you know, what I would want people to come out of the cinema saying is, okay, that may not have been, you know, the Arthur that I've carried in my mind all these years, but it really was an Arthur. And that's what, you know, I think that's what you're hoping for.
Sure, sure. As I've listened to the books and read the books, the thing that strikes me about them, and that actually surprised me about them, is the humor and the wonderful language. And so I guess one of my concerns about the movie is I'm afraid this is going to be a space action movie. How do you protect that wonderful language and the humor and make it more than just rockets and people flying through space?
I think you cast somebody like Stephen Fry, and you have the guide entries, and you have so many lines which people will recognize from the books. I mean, you cannot in a movie clearly be as discursive as you are in the book. You just can't. But you'll be surprised how many guide entries are in there that you'll go, oh, that's great, that's in there. And of course, there are plenty that aren't. But there's a lot of guide entries. And I think you'll find that basic sense of wit and intelligence still very much suffuses the movie.
You mentioned the guide entries.
Yeah.
Now, written 25 years ago, the whole guide must have seemed very futuristic, but today it sounds a lot like an ebook, or it even sounds like Audible and iTunes technology, and that you've got
something indeed. That
talks to you. So how do you make that fresh? How do you make that still seem futuristic when you present in the movie?
You take exactly the opposite direction, and you don't try and make it look futuristic. we decided to sort of go down quite a low-tech route. So you've got a very simple, bold, visual graphic language, which, you know, if you were trying to create a graphic language which would be recognizable to many different species around the galaxy, it would need to be quite simple and quite bold in its look. The actual device itself looks a bit like a Swiss Army knife. It looks like a really rugged book that you could genuinely, you know, pop in your bag and take around with you. The example I often use is if you think about a movie like Minority Report, which had a fantastic, you know, that all that wonderful graphics there, that haptic virtual reality, in the air floating in front of you. Well, that technology idea is now being used by an electrical store over here in the UK to sell DVDs and kettles, and that's just 18 months later. So what we tried to do was not to try and come up with something which was, you know, where we thought state of the art futuristic is, because nothing dates more quickly. But by already giving it a slightly retro feel, if you like, we'd blown past that, and so that's what we've decided to do.
Tell me about the Douglas Adams writing process. There are 5 books in the Hitchhiker's Guide series, and the series is officially called a trilogy. How did it happen that there were 5 books written?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he started, I mean, in a way, Douglas always said he fell into novel writing by accident. I mean, he always planned to be a scriptwriter. That's what he planned to be.
I see.
And that's, you know, so when he did his stuff for Doctor Who, or when he did his stuff writing the scripts for the radio series, that's where he thought he was going to be. But then, of course, the idea for a novel comes up, and it becomes massively successful. So what do? You write another novel, and people love that, and they want another one, and they want another one, and another one. So you just get drawn into it. And in some ways, Douglas was sort of very constitutionally ill-suited to being a novelist. I mean, the loneliness of being a novelist. Douglas was a very gregarious person. And, you know, he wanted to be the leader of a team and was a primary creative person, he quite liked, I think, the collaborative aspects of working in a team. I mean, you know, maybe as the scriptwriter, but nevertheless, if you're working in a team as a scriptwriter, maybe there's a director around or a producer around. And I think he found novel writing just very lonely.
Is there more to come from Douglas Adams? Were there things that haven't been published yet, or any recently found manuscripts?
Oh, yes. But I'm not going to say anything more about that. The answer is yes. If this movie goes as well as we all hope it is, just, you know, watch this space over the coming years.
Great. Terrific. How exciting.
No manuscripts, but there are some brand new original ideas and things for movies. Maybe a line description or things which have been more firmly worked out, which he did leave behind, and which obviously the estate owns. And there's not an undiscovered manuscript, but there is some very, very interesting film and film ideas in there.
Wonderful. There must be some really wild stories, I would think, about Hitchhiker fans. Can you share one or two with us?
Gosh, wild stories about Hitchhiker fans.
Yes.
This isn't that wild, but I mean, I think the studio executives were amazed when they did a screening in Pasadena and it seemed like 75% of the audience turned up with their towels, which I sort of rather enjoy. And, I'm very mindful of how much this means to everybody, so I spend quite a lot of time, you know, looking out on the forums. I never post. I've never posted. Sometimes I've been quite tempted to sort of say to somebody who's busy, you know, upset about something, just saying, oh, if you knew how hard we were working and how much we cared about this. We really do care. Honestly, I know you're concerned, but, you know, don't be concerned that we don't care. Well, you know, maybe we'll get it wrong, but don't be concerned that we don't care, and don't be concerned that the studio doesn't care. So I've read some pretty wild postings out there. I just love the passion. I mean, I was in Australia just last week I did 2 big events, an event at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and then an event at Sydney, and they were both packed out. And people just love it. And, you know, I think, the Disney team over there were amazed, really, at the passion that they felt from this audience who, you know, queued to get into these events. And they bought towels and for me to sign, and they... I signed all sorts of things, T-shirts. I just love it when you're actually right there in front of... That's the best for me, is when you're right there in front of people who are just willing it to be good, frightened that it won't be, and then actually relieved when they see what we've done and feel, oh, my God, maybe they haven't screwed it up.
That's terrific. And the reaction so far has been positive?
I think the reaction's been very positive, and I know that the 4 or 5 of the guys who used to work with Douglas and I at our company, who I trust immensely. Douglas adored them. I mean, he worked very closely with them. They were some extremely clever programmers, and 1 or 2 amongst them are extremely good writers as well. And they've seen the movie, and that was one of the most important moments for me was their reaction, because they're a very straight-talking bunch, and, you know, although they like me, they wouldn't have hesitated to tell me, or, you know, I'd have seen in their eyes if they'd been disappointed, but they loved it. Douglas's wife and daughter have seen it, and they loved it. And I think think the good reaction that is pleasing all of us at the moment is that fans, I'm sure they'll find the odd thing, but basically I think when they're seeing it, they're going, ah, it is Our Hitchhikers, and it's a good movie as well. But non-fans are seeing it, and they're thoroughly enjoying it. They're picking up on that fabulous mixture of what makes it unique. And I alluded to this very briefly earlier, the whale. There's a moment where two thermonuclear missiles, which have been sent to blow up the Heart of Gold, which is the main spaceship, as it approaches a planet called Magrathea, and these missiles are turned into a bowl of petunias and a sperm whale. And the sperm whale falls to Earth, basically, really, effectively, meditating on the relationship between language and existence, and naming itself and naming its environment. And then it comes to the ground, and it names the ground, and it hopes that it'll be friends with it, and of course it isn't, and the whale goes splat. And there in that sequence, you've got everything in my mind that just sums up Douglas's genius. You've got the wild invention of turning missiles into a whale and a bowl of petunias. And incidentally, as the bowl of petunias falls, it says, oh no, not again. And many people have speculated that if we knew why it was saying that, we'd know a lot more about the nature of the universe than we do now. So you've got these fabulous intelligence, thoughtfulness that makes Hitchhiker special. And then you've got a great joke. So what more can you want? Invention, ideas, and fabulous humor, all in the one space of, you know, the space of this one scene. And so for me, having the whale scene in was always a real litmus test for the movie, because it comes at a moment in the movie where traditionally you'd be driving hard towards the end of the, you know, our heroes, our characters, they've arrived at their planet, which they've been trying to get to, this planet Magrathea, and you'd be driving towards the end of the movie. Last 20 minutes, drive, drive, drive. That's what you'd classically be doing in a classic Hollywood movie. But no, what we do is we go off on this little wonderful discursive moment with a whale. And I just think that says everything about the approach we've taken to the movie. And what's been great is that in the screenings we've been doing, people love that scene, fans and non-fans alike. How many other movies are you going to see a scene like that? Not very many. And I think that's the great thing about Hitchhikers, is it's just unique. You can't describe it as a cross between this and that. It is itself. And I think it's going to come up on the rails this summer. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people, and I think a lot of people are just going to go, where did that come from? Paradoxically, despite the fact that it's been around a long time, I think a lot of people are going to discover it anew, and it'll just be one of those movies that just sits there, you know, uniquely itself.
That's great. How do you film a whale going splat? And how many whales did you need?
Oh, no, no whales were harmed during the making of this movie. It's a very big model.
Okay.
We built a big model, and then we filmed it, and then put sky falling back on it digitally and so on. So, there's no whales harmed during the making of this movie.
Robbie, have you been involved in other movies, or is this your first?
This is my first big movie. I was closely involved with Douglas and the company, so I've been a sort of media exec, and I've done computer games and internet and books and TV and so on, but this is the first movie, and I've been lucky enough to work across the whole piece. I mean, I've worked on, you know, I've worked closely with the marketing teams and the internet teams and the DVD team and the game teams and the licensing and merchandising teams, so I've been able to sort of bring a hitchhikery perspective to every element, but I've had a whale of a time. It's been fantastic.
In listening to the audiobooks that Douglas Adams recorded, I was struck by how well he performed those. Did he have some acting background?
He'd certainly been a performer at Cambridge when he was in Footlights. And he was a very, I mean, you know, like Dickens, he was a terrific performer of his own books. He really was. He was sensationally good at it.
What did he like to read?
Douglas read voraciously. I mean, I think towards the end of his life, he tended to read a lot more factual books than he read fiction. One of the enormous influences on his life comedically was P.G. Wodehouse, who I think he regarded as just, you know, one of the greatest exponents of the English language that, you know, there's ever been. But latterly, he loved to read science, and he would read everything he could lay his hands on about evolution and, you know, consciousness and thinking about who we are and where we are and where we came from and so on. He read voraciously around, particularly around popular science, and not just popular science, but I mean, he read some, you know, quite heavy stuff. So writers like Richard Dawkins, for example, the, you know, the great writer on evolution, who wrote The Selfish Gene and The Blind Watchmaker, that Douglas again and again would cite as being, you know, enormous influences on him intellectually.
What's the legacy Adams leaves us besides the books and the movies? Is there something else?
What an interesting question. I mean, there was another book, of course, Last Chance to See, which was the book about conservation, you know, visiting endangered species around the world, of which he was immensely proud. In fact, often he would say it was the book of which he was most proud. What does he leave us? I think there were two and this is a very personal view, but I think there were two core underlying themes in Douglass's certainly latter life intellectually. One was that humankind should have just a little bit more humility about its place in the great big scheme of things than it does, instead of seeing itself as the apex of this universe. The example he always used to use brilliantly to describe this, and it's a very good example of how clever he was at finding these images, was a puddle. So, you know, a puddle wakes up one morning and it looks around at its world and its environment, and gosh, this hole's very fits me very perfectly. In fact, this hole must have been made just exactly for me. And it continues to think that as the sun comes out and dries it up. And I think that's a very good little little metaphor for understanding Douglass's, just as I say, wish that there was a little bit more humility in us. And the second, I think, is having said all that, through the exploration of the works of people like Richard Dawkins and so on, and a genuine awe and reverence for the phenomenal beauties of what we do have on this little lump of rock in this unregarded spot, this unregarded part of the galaxy. You know, he was just fascinated by how simplicity emerges out of all of this complexity, and that was a deep love and enjoyment of that. And I think those are two themes which you know we could all do well with exploring.
Absolutely. Robbie, what comes next for you? What are you going to be working on next?
Well, if people love this movie the way that I really hope they're going to, then clearly, you know, there's the possibility for sequels. And as I alluded very briefly, there are some brand new, never before heard of Douglas Adams ideas sitting there, which I know that the estate would very much love to see have the light of day. And I'm rather hoping that I would, with some, you know, key trusted people, be able to nurse some of those into life.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Nid, for giving me so much time. I really appreciate it. And I really hope everybody loves the movie. People who know the books and people who don't. I just hope everybody goes and has a really great time and then goes and sees it again, because it's so rich, so much in there, you won't get it all first time.
Sounds wonderful. Robbie Stamp, thank you so much for your time. It's been a lot of fun talking to you today.
You're welcome.
This is Beth Anderson, publisher of Audible.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.